Hi, hello. Welcome to Mary's Cup of Tea, the self-love podcast for women, though all self-lovers are welcome here. I'm Mary. I write and speak about self-love, and I'm best known for my book, The Gift of Self-Love, and I also host retreats for women. And this is the podcast that will inspire you to love yourself. Real quick, before we dive in, I want to make sure you know about my book, The Gift of Self-Love. It's a workbook to help you build confidence, recognize your worth, and learn to love who you are. It's available anywhere books are sold. Thousands of people have it, love it, and have told me that it has greatly benefited their self-love journey, and I hope it'll do the same for you. And now let's get into the podcast. I have a really encouraging episode for you today. Our guest is Ryan Prentice. She's a nutritionist and therapist who helps people struggling with binge eating. And today we talk about how to release that residual shame one might have, even if you're not, say, binge eating every single night, like I used to. Maybe you've come a long way in healing your relationship with food, but there's still some leftover guilt that happens whenever you choose what to eat, or there's still some like background thoughts happening about what you should or shouldn't have on your plate. Ryan's voice is just so wholesome, warm, welcoming, and honestly healing. This was such a sweet episode. We talk about a mantra for releasing food guilt. It's something that Ryan has become pretty known for. Why binge eating is not really about the food itself and what it's actually about. Ryan also explains like step by step how to handle fear foods or, you know, those foods that might trigger you back into old patterns. How do you reintroduce them into your life and hopefully not be afraid of them anymore? How to recover from disordered eating if you're living with somebody. That's a big one, because whether it's a partner, a roommate, you're living with your family at home, obviously everybody has their own unique relationship with food. So how do you hold space for your own healing while not infringing on somebody else's food freedom? Ryan Nicole, like I mentioned, she's a therapist and nutritionist. I think it's just the perfect combo for the work that she's doing. She's known for revolutionizing how people heal their relationship with food, not with more rules or rigidity, but with self-trust and a massive perspective shift. Using her binge eating recovery story as the heart of her message and her clinical expertise as the backbone, Ryan brings a refreshing, relatable voice to the wellness space. Couldn't agree with that more. You can follow Ryan on Instagram. She's at Ryan Nicole. It's going to have like three N's in her username. And check out her binge eating recovery programs. I'm going to link them in the description, or you can go to itsryannicole.com/coaching. The way I found out about Ryan is through somebody who came on one of my retreats, and she was speaking so highly about this program as being transformative in her binge eating recovery to a point where she literally doesn't binge eat anymore, and that is thanks to Ryan's program. So if that's something you're struggling with, I highly recommend checking out Ryan and seeing if you can work with her. Now, without further ado, let's welcome Ryan Nicole to the show to talk about why binge eating is not really about the food and how you can release some of that residual shame and hopefully heal your relationship with eating. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to Mary's Cup of Tea.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Let's start by talking about your mantra that you became pretty popular for. You say you don't have to make it mean so much. What does that do for you? And how did you come up with it?
I used to have this series where I would go through different food fears and I would eat them and I would talk about beyond the fear, what are we really doing here? And kind of different ways to think about food and kind of breaking down the beliefs that we have around food. That's where it started in one of those videos. I think I just very quickly said, like, I don't need to make this mean so much. And it was one of those things where like the comments were like, whoa, like that just like really changed so much of my brain chemistry, just like that one mantra. And then I had people emailing me and commenting and DMing me. I use that in so many areas of my life. I don't need to make this mean so much. And it's been one of those sayings that really makes you take a step back and realize how much pressure and meaning and perfection and control we put on things, and take a step back and be like, what? Like, I don't have to make this mean so much. Why am I making this mean so much? This doesn't have to be that big of a deal, and I can let go. So in a way, it's giving yourself permission to let go and relax a little bit.
Yeah. And I'm sure around food, that's particularly transformative, because we've been told the exact opposite, that we need to stay in control and rigid and diet and monitor and scrutinize ourselves constantly.
And all of the meaning too. It's not just a cookie. It is, I've been bad, or I ruined the day, or this means this about me, or I've been weak, and all of these things that get attached to the cookie. Like, that's the meaning. Those are the things that we are adding on to it. We don't have to add those. And so when we say, I don't need to make this mean so much, that's like, I can remind myself that this is just a cookie, and this doesn't have to mean anything about me. And that totally changes the trajectory on how you think around food, how you approach food, your emotions around food. I mean, obviously, it's not like an end all be all, say this and you're healed. But it is one of those things, as a tool, as you are doing these things and you're noticing how much emotion is tied up in food. And why that hit so hard is because it's not just about the cookie. It's about all the meaning that's attached to it.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said that, you know, the mantra isn't going to heal everything. What is your advice for someone who is struggling, making the cookie mean a lot about them, and not just the cookie, but every meal? I have this, just a really quick side note. One thing that I wish more people in recovery would understand, whether that's applied to body image or relationship with food, is that the times when you feel good about yourself for being, you know, having a salad or looking a certain way. But to me, the way I see it is that the more meaning you attach to those like good things that society says is good, it's also like the equal and opposite thing of when we're feeling like bad around food or like bad with our bodies.
100%. I mean, I think it just goes back to the reality that like, this is so much more than the food. And this is now about who you are as a person. And that's when everything gets so complicated.
Mm-hmm. Like whether it's positive or negative.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the very first thing that I would say to someone that is in that space is to just acknowledge that this is what's happening. Because I think for so long, it's very easy to stay in denial and justify. I'm just being healthy, or it's not that big of a deal, or things could be so much worse, or, you know, maybe this is kind of affecting my life, but is it really that bad? And acknowledging when it's affecting your life and it's in your brain that much, allowing yourself to maybe admit that this is something that you are struggling with. And if this is something that you are struggling with, then maybe the next step isn't more control and more discipline. Maybe it's actually healing.
You often say that it's not about the food. What is it about then?
I get that question all the time, right? It's like, what do you mean it's not about the food? If we look at food as the solution, the binges as the solution, and I know that sounds like the wildest thing, so hear me out. For someone who is having such a hard time is not saying it about the food, I always love to ask the question, if you didn't have food to blame, what would you have to face instead? Because food is such an easy thing to grip onto as the almost easy, in quotes, thing that if I just change, if I just fix, if I just get right, then everything in my life is going to get better. But when we take a step back and we zoom out and we look at what the food is really doing for you, because you wouldn't be using the food, whether it's an emotional way or whether it's in a binge way, if it wasn't giving you something. And so it's not just you're eating because you love the food. If it was about the food, it would be, I just love like the taste of food and I love enjoying food and I love eating food. And I have people say, but I do, like, I can't stop eating because it tastes so good. And you need to look at how you're experiencing the food in those moments. Like, yes, it tastes good, but like, are you like embracing that it tastes good? Is it, this is so good? Or is it so good because it's letting you turn off? Is it so good because it's giving you a dopamine hit, or because it's allowing you to escape or focusing on something else, or you don't have any other pleasure in your day? So this is like the one time that you get pleasure. So if it's not about the food, it's about escape. It's about avoidance. It's about meeting your needs. And that's really tough, because if it's not about the food and it's about that, then that's a much bigger thing to work with, to work on, and to tackle.
I think for me, if it's not about the food, if it wasn't about the food and I didn't have food to blame, I would say it feels so good because it's forbidden and because I feel rebellious. And I like that.
It's the one time you get to turn off. It's like you're trying to be in control all day long, all day long, all day long. And I always give the analogy of like the kid who grew up in a really, really strict home and then goes to college and goes crazy. It's like, it's because all of a sudden, like all the limits are off, all the rules are off. And it's like, F it, right? You only say F it if there's something to say F it to. What are you saying F it to? The rules, the control, the having to be perfect, having to stay in line, the discipline, all of it. And it's the time that you get to be free. And when you take that band-aid off or you take that layer off and you're already there, it's like, well, I've already blown it. So I might as well go 100% in. And that part feels liberating, almost exciting.
Yeah, totally. For me, it was like not just exciting in the moment, but contrast that to how in control I'm going to get back on the wagon starting Monday. And this is my last and final chance, you know, the last supper before we murder Jesus.
The high of that too, like the high of the planning, the binge, getting the food, having all the food, eating it. And then the whole thing we tell ourselves about this being the last time, and okay, I've gotten it completely out of my system and thank God I ate all that food. So now it's not here anymore. And then it's like, okay, here we go. Here's the diet. This is going to be the time that I get everything right and I never do this again. And my life is going to be changed. But because it was never about the food, and because just saying I'm never going to binge again isn't enough to never binge again, keeps happening.
Yeah, totally. How do you recommend navigating those trigger foods? You mentioned like, thank God I ate it all, so now they're not here anymore and I can start over. Like, if we have, I think a lot of our listeners might not be binge eating every single night, but still might have some foods that feel like the forbidden fruit that kind of set them off. Maybe it's not like as bad as it used to be, but it still feels frantic and filled with shame. For the foods that trigger us in that way, do you recommend keeping them out of the house, avoiding them, or stocking up? I don't know, being really abundant about it, or is there somewhere in between?
So I take the approach where I want you to feel really empowered and good when you start bringing these foods into the house, because that's what we need to do. We need to normalize them. And the more that you keep them out of the house and you tell yourself, I'm the person who can't control myself around this food, the more that belief just gets reinforced and it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then when they are in the house, when they are in your possession, they are so incredibly exciting. So what I have my clients do is I want you to think about the foods that you are maybe around or you're going to be around, or the foods that you would like to be able to have in the house and be okay. So I think of, let's say you're, you know, a parent and there are kid foods that you would really like to buy or be able to buy for your kids, but you're like, I can't. And it sucks because they love these foods, but you won't buy them because you're so afraid to have them in the house. Like thinking about foods like that, or if you go to dinner events, like what are the foods that are usually there? Like I always think like chips and salsa, right? Like that's a go-to, or like a charcuterie or things like that. Like those are foods that I would, like I think about the foods that you being okay around is going to add a lot more just joy to your life, ease to your life, like foods that you're maybe never around or you never think to eat or don't really appeal to you. Like, could you work on those? Sure. But I don't really think those are top of mind. So think about those foods first, put them on a list and rank them from 1 to 5. 1 being this feels challenging, a little bit scary, but doable. 2, 5, I cannot imagine having that in my possession right now. I do not trust myself around that food. Like, absolutely no, I can't buy that. And let's start with the ones, and let's start with buying 1 or 2. And when you buy it, I recommend knowing how you're going to eat it and knowing what you're going to buy. So these are some of the things that I see get people really caught up when it comes to challenging themselves with foods. They're like, I'm just going to use the chips example because that's easy. Okay, I'm going to work on chips this week. And that's the end. And so they go to the grocery store and they go to the chip aisle and they see the 40 different kinds of chips. And then it's so overwhelming. And they're like, what am I going to buy? And they buy all these different chips and they're so excited about all the different chips. And they come home and they just want to eat it all. It's like your intention was so amazing. And we just need to put a little bit more structure there because this is going to be a lot. So know what chips, or, you know, a few ideas of the chips that you're gonna have before you go there. So you're not overwhelmed when you're looking at all these different kinds. So do you want salt and vinegar? Do you want like classic, you know, Lay's? Do you want barbecue? Whatever. What do you want? So that when you get there, you know what you're getting. How are you gonna eat them? So I'm gonna have chips. Okay, I'm gonna get the barbecue chips and I'm going to have them every single day with my lunch, whether it's a salad or a sandwich, and I'm going to have them with a snack plate. So I need to make sure that I have things to like add them into my snack plate. So then when you get home and you're so excited, it's like, I know how I'm going to eat them. And when you do eat them and you're so excited to keep having them, you can remind yourself, okay, but I'm going to have them with my next snack. I'm going to have them with my next lunch. I'm going to have them with my next snack, so that you feel really good about it. Does that mean that doing it that way, you're not gonna just go wild and have the whole bag? No, right? Like you're learning and you're practicing, but the more that you can look at it as a practice, it takes the pressure off. The thing I always say with trigger foods, and I don't know about you, but for me, I had this idea that if I started with challenging trigger foods, fear foods, whatever, it meant that now I had to eat those things. So it meant that every time I had a sandwich, I would have to have it with chips. Or it meant that, you know, every time I had coffee, I had to put real cream in it or whatever. The point of you challenging trigger foods and fear foods is for you to feel neutral around them, so you get to ultimately choose what you want. If you don't want chips, you don't have to have chips. But now you know it's coming from a place of, I am choosing rather than I am so terrified.
Yeah. Yeah. The agency in that is empowering for sure. I really love that you brought up like having somebody in your house, like a child. You're like, I want to get goldfish for my child. Goldfish, Cheez-Its, that kind of stuff used to get me. Or even living with a roommate, your partner. I had this big shame of like, I don't want to
impose my like weirdness onto them and tell them they can't buy something or have it in the house or eat it. And then, you know, there's lots of complicated emotions mixed into watching them, whether that's jealousy or resentment. And then ultimately that leading to getting triggered to binge. What do you do then? Like, how do you recover while living with somebody else?
Steph, I was in college when I was struggling in high school, but college is when it really got exacerbated because I was on my own, had roommates. They always got the good snacks. So it was always me in the middle of the night binging on their food and then running to the 24-hour CVS to replace it because what was I going to tell them and what was the lie that I was going to come up with? It's definitely more complex when you're living with other people. And if we make this into a positive, things have to change faster because you don't really have the choice to tiptoe in because the food's already there. It's kind of like they're already there. So now I need to learn and practice and heal everything that is going on that is making these foods so hard. I will say, though, that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you are living in a house with none of your trigger foods or if you are living with people that are buying all of your trigger foods. When you struggle with binge eating, and you know this, I know this, it doesn't matter. When you have the urge, you will binge on anything. So in a way, I think that it makes healing harder because you're not able to take those tiptoes. But when it comes to the belief that we like to tell ourselves that this would be so much easier if I didn't have all this food around, I don't know that that's true. And I think that you can probably acknowledge that when you have the urge to binge, you'll binge on anything.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I had the worst of my binge eating was a 2-year time period. And this is actually a pretty controlled experiment. One of those years was living completely on my own. And the other one of those years was living with my now ex. Both times, I don't even know what's worse. You can't really say the isolation of being all by yourself and gorging food, the suffocating and shame alone, or the extra added thing of feeling like watched and judged by somebody else. Like, I've heard the roommate thing so much, like people in college getting into their roommate's food and then trying to be secretive about it. Like you said, either way, it's like a drug. You find a way and you need to heal and recover in any environment.
I 100% agree. I mean, that's just the reality of it. And it's always easy to say grass is greener. I think when you're in that place and you realize that I don't want to live this way anymore, let's focus less on the issues with the environment and more on how we can get you to the other side as fast as possible so that you can be with the food and have the food and have the events and have the joy to get back into your life.
Can I ask how your personal journey intersected with the education and knowledge that you've gained? Like, how did this work? Did you binge eat through school in becoming a therapist? And you're also a nutritionist. So I love how those two things work in such great benefit to you and your clients now. Like, how did that work for your personal journey?
So it's very backwards. I was binging in high school, went to college. Where I went to college, you didn't have to declare your major until sophomore year. At this time in my life, losing weight and controlling my food was the most important thing to me. That's all I cared about. And so when I was thinking about what I wanted to major in, I kid you not, I had the thought, I know how I'm supposed to eat. Like, I know what I should eat. I don't know why my brain is broken and I can't do it. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to major in psychology so I can learn everything that I can about the brain and I can fix my brain and I can lose the weight. And then when I'm in a smaller body, then it won't really matter what my job is. Like, everything's going to just like fall into place and be like magical and fairies and rainbows, right? And so I started majoring in psychology, started learning more about the brain, and it got more complicated because I felt like I understood the brain more and I was understanding my behaviors more, but I still didn't understand why. Like, I still didn't understand why I was doing the things that I was doing. And so at the end of my sophomore year, a year of basically learning about psychology, being so in the depths of the binge restrict cycle, that's kind of when I hit my breaking point. And the summer between my sophomore and junior year, I went to outpatient treatment for binge eating. And that's the first time that I had done really any work specific to binge eating. Been to therapists before. I had been to, you know, other things trying to help me with my food, but nothing binge eating specific. And that is where I met the therapist that like absolutely changed my life. And I think the thing that was so special about her that was different about my other therapists, and not that my other therapist didn't do anything that different, I was clearly the one who was not ready to change, not willing to listen. I do remember the day that she disclosed that she had struggled actually with bulimia and she was in recovery. By me hearing that, it just like opened up this new layer of trust that I was like, you're not just someone talking at me as like this superior, I read this in a book, like it's not that big of a deal, like just don't eat it kind of thing. And someone who had like a really deep understanding. And after I had worked with her and done so much healing work, it was this moment of I so deeply want to be the person that wasn't there when I needed them. And I cannot imagine that I've been through all of this for it to just be done. Like, I just feel like there's something more. So I finished my bachelor's, got my master's, and then I started all of the requirements that it takes to become a therapist. And becoming a certified nutritionist just seemed like something else to add into that on top of like all of my continuing education. Not because I think that, how do I want to say this? Not because it was necessary because it's about the food, because it's not about the food, but I do feel like there are some elements that I needed to know when it comes to, we do know that if you're not eating enough, like you will binge, right? Like there is an emotional element 100%. And for many people, it is, you have to eat enough. Like you have, and like, knowing these different dynamics of food and just understanding it a little bit more, I just wanted to make sure that I basically checked every box for my client. So that is how that kind of came about. So it was never a, I'm going to be a therapist. And when I was struggling with binge eating, it was never, I'm going to overcome this. And when I do, I'm going to become a therapist. It kind of just happened in a really, I guess, beautiful way.
Is that why in your bio you have recovered binge eater? I get it.
Yes.
Hey, self-lover, sorry to interrupt, but do you have my self-love playlist? There's over 300, if not 400 songs on it that are so fun and uplifting and empowering, and I think will really be perfect for when you're getting ready, trying to hype yourself up, dealing with a bad body image day, or anytime you just want a little boost of self-love, these tracks will do it for you. So head to maryscupoftea.com/playlist to get it, and know that I am dancing and jamming with you from afar. Cheers.
It's rare for therapists to be, well, traditional therapists to be open about their struggles too. But I think with binge eating specifically, there's so much shame involved in it. The only other community that is really open about their struggles, even as they're mentoring and guiding people through them, is the recovery, like, drug and alcohol recovery programs, right? Where even your mentors, you know, they're in recovery and you know they get it. And that's why hopefully you call them.
And with all of this shame, when you're in it, even though you hear that other people struggle with it, you don't believe it. You start telling yourself things like, well, maybe they struggle with it, but they don't struggle as bad as me. Or maybe they binge, but they don't binge like I binge. Or you know, maybe they experience this, but they don't experience it on my level. And when it comes to any kind of healing, I am such a firm believer in community and group because I think that so much healing happens when you hear other people share because of that shame, because it really shifts you from believing this is a me problem, something's wrong with me, to, oh, we're kind of all here from the same root or a similar root, working on the same thing. And everyone here is incredible and they're amazing and they're so smart and, you know, wonderful people. And if I think that about them and I see that about them and all of these incredible people struggle, then what does that mean?
Totally. That's, I mean, wow. So well said. That's why I host retreats, because like groups in person, it's just hits different. It lands differently.
It does. It does. And the more that I can keep sharing and normalizing, the more that people see the hope, they understand that this doesn't have to be their life forever. I think because it's such an isolating thing, there's a lot of people that truly believe like this is just them, like this is just their life. Like they're always going to be the kind of person that struggles with food, or they're always going to be the kind of person that's always thinking about food. And to hear stories of recovery and all different layers of recovery, whether it's going to an inpatient treatment or from, I did it myself because I didn't have any other options, it's just really cool to see and hear.
Do you have clear markers in your mind about your personal journey of like pre-recovery, during recovery, and post-recovery? Asking because I sometimes kind of count the years and I have like very loose dates in my mind of where I kind of like stopped binge eating. But now I'm at a point where I haven't done it in so long, I don't even really remember. Honestly, coming up with questions for this interview was a little difficult because I'm like, I don't even remember what that was like. And I don't want to sound disconnected or vain in that way, but it's just like I've come so far that, yeah, I just didn't want to make anybody feel weird about it if they're in it. So I think there's this space, though, that I was in, which was, I'm not fully a binge eater. You mentioned the intellectualizing, like I know the behaviors, I know why I do it, but I also don't feel fully free, whether there's some residual shame or complicated thoughts and feelings, you know, the urge to like compensate for what you eat or justify it somehow, some way. What, like, how do you see the recovery journey in its entirety?
Such an interesting question.
It's a big one.
I don't know that I've ever really thought about it like that. And the reason why I don't, if I'm being so honest, is because, and I'll be the first one to say, I don't think that I healed my relationship with food, went through binge eating recovery, and then since then, it's been like all amazing. For me, the cycle did a lot of jumping. So it went from food to alcohol to relationships to work to spending. And so I feel like for me, it's been kind of this like noticing how the pattern shifts and continuing to bring it back to different roots or different layers or different things that I haven't basically uncovered yet. And I think that that's just part of being human. Like we move through life and there are different stages that open up a new door. Like when I had a baby, that brought up like a whole new layer of things that I was like, wow, okay, here we go again. And I think that the more that we can look at it as just a journey rather than it being an endpoint. And I think that that's what gets people either frustrated or just like it feels like it's going to be going on forever. Like when we can look at it as just like, it is a journey, like it ebbs and flows, there's ups and downs. And if it's not with food, it's probably going to be with something else because you're a human being. And like, that's just what happens. And for most of us, we are very perfectionistic type A. And so we tend to, you know, fall back on that control piece. But I will say, to speak to your point about like forgetting those pieces, I really think the only reason why I don't is because I am working so closely with people that are like telling their stories over and over and over again. So like, I hear that, but I will say that sometimes it does feel hard to continue having these conversations when I work so hard to not have these conversations. And what I mean by that is, you know this, we work so hard to not think about food and body. And now it's like, I've built a career around that. And sometimes it feels like, is this what I'm going to be doing forever? I don't know. I really don't know. I know that right now, this is kind of what I'm called to do. But are there days where I'm like, I'm so tired of talking about this? 100%. And I think that that too is really normal and maybe part of this journey as well.
Ryan, that's the most unexpected yet relatable response for me. Both parts, like where the pattern translates. For me, it definitely went into social media, the dopamine hit, the binge consuming, the binge scrolling, then the trying to detox from it, beating myself up, perfectionist, having it wrapped up in my job, just like fitness was when I was into that. So there's a part of me that's like, fuck, like I just turned one beast into a different one. Yeah. And, you know, getting tired of talking about it definitely relates to, I think that's why I've just felt so lost for a while. Cause it's like, if you define yourself by what you struggle with and then being anti that thing, anti diet or anti, I don't know, productivity or anti whatever, it's still contingent upon the core of whatever you're against.
And then it's like, well, why did you make this your job? I don't think we always know, right? Like, I don't think that we know like what's going to happen. I definitely didn't know that it was going to turn into what it is today. I had the idea that this is what I wanted to do. And as I was collecting all of the hours for my internship, COVID happened. And that's when I started my Instagram and started my Instagram literally as a passion project. And then it turned into what it is now. It's interesting because I feel like when I was in recovery, one of the hardest things, and I do think to go back to your question of, okay, I'm not binging anymore, but I'm still obsessing. Whoa, this is really coming full circle. It's the identity piece. It is, but who am I without the food? Or who am I if I'm not the healthy one or the fit one? Or if I'm not the one that's like always, you know, on top of this or control it, like who am I? And I feel like I went through that a little bit after recovery and doing that and figuring out who I am. And I feel like there's a part of me that's doing that again right now. Like, if this isn't my work, if I'm not talking about this anymore, who am I? What do I do? What do I have left? And wow, that was like really vulnerable. But it's true. And that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Firstly, I'm sure that relates in many different capacities to a lot of people. And I know it does for me. My latest soapbox is that we all need not just a hobby, but diversified hobbies. So we don't put all our self-esteem eggs in one basket. Like, people laugh at me when I say this and they think I'm lying. I'm really good at pickleball. It's been my thing for the past 2 years. I play every single day. I never post about it on social media. That has been so freaking liberating. I could be having the worst shit day and I'll go on the courts. And even if I play like shit on the courts, it's like the best release for me. It just scratches something. And I've boiled it down to pickleball punishes you for not being present. So it's really about presence. you know? I feel like in yoga, you can get away with like talking and thinking and whatever, you know what I mean? But pickleball specifically, like there's nothing I'm thinking about besides like eye on the ball. And that has been freaking awesome, especially knowing that it's not going to lead to a pro pickleball career with sponsorships and money and identity being known for it. Do you know what I mean?
You know what? That just made me think about 100% because this has been a conversation that I feel like I've had with a lot of my groups lately, but also a conversation that I feel like I've been having a lot with myself after becoming a mom is the concept of play and getting back into play and having fun. Like, I don't know about you, but when I was in my eating disorder and binge eating and everything, it was like, I was so serious all the time, like never fun, never fun, never fun. And I would always blame my body for the reason why I never had friends or never had relationships, never stopping to look at. Maybe it's because I'm just like not that fun to be around. And then it's like, I've always been so serious. And then it went into work and the grind and the hustle and losing play. And what am I doing if it's not productive, to the point where I've gotten a lot better. But I'll never forget when I was with a new therapist and we were talking about relationships and we were talking about fun. And she was like, what do you do for fun? And I was like, what fun? I don't have, who does fun?
Who's that?
And she was like, do you ever read for fun? And I was like, read for fun? Why would I read for, what's the point? What's the point? And the ironic thing about that is that 4 months after that, it was like a really rainy day. I had nothing to do. And I had come off of just like a massive TikTok scroll. And it was right when Book Talk was big and everyone was talking about Colleen Hoover. And so I picked up one of her books and I read it in a day. And I was like, that was incredible. Like that was it. And since then I've been reading for fun, but that has been just like a piece and learning how to have fun and letting myself have fun and play. And that's what I think about with your pickleball. Like that's what you get with that.
Totally, totally. And I primarily read only fiction now. Actually, me reading fiction kind of coincides when I started playing pickleball. Same thing. Don't post about it too much. I don't do Book Talk. I'm not trying to draw lessons. I'm not, you know what I mean? It's just pure pleasure. And that is something that we rob ourselves from so much when we are struggling with, I think mostly body image. Cause like you said, the thought is that like, I don't deserve love, affection, you know, fun, enjoyment, anything beyond trying to fix myself. That should be my only focus. And then I can have fun. But until then, I don't deserve it. I just came across a video on TikTok too that was like, do it fat. When I tell myself, like, I'm too fat to go on a hike, do it fat. You know, I just loved how real she was about that. Cause I wish I could have told myself back then, cause I didn't even, there were so many things that I robbed myself of when I felt fat.
And in the cycle, it's been hitting a lot harder recently, I feel like, as I feel like you and I are similar ages. So you're probably in the same boat, but in the wedding phase where everyone's getting married and seeing people go to all of these weddings and talking to people and them asking, oh my God, I have 7 weddings this year. Like, are you just getting flooded with weddings? And I'm like, no, because I don't have high school friends because food was my best friend. And in the beginning of college, it was the same thing. And it's really sad sometimes to think about like those things that I missed out on. And I think that that was a fire under my booty for change because I was like, hell no, am I missing out on anymore? Like, I will not let this continue because I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to miss out on anymore.
It's crazy you say that because yesterday I got into a dark place after seeing a comment. I don't remember even what the original video was, but the comment was, if you don't talk to any of your friends from high school, that's a red flag. And I was like, oh my God, am I a red flag? Because I don't really talk to any friends of high school besides one, maybe occasionally, but you're now
you're affirming that it's not a red flag. It's called mental health struggles.
And that we change and relationships change. And God forbid that you've outgrown people. Like, I think that that's probably a whole other conversation in and of itself, but letting yourself and allowing yourself to grow out of people, and that's totally okay. And that happens.
Yeah. And it's not too late. Like, it's not too late to make new friends, to reconnect with old ones, to pick up a new hobby. I have a retreat sister who I find particularly inspiring because she picked up salsa when she was like 28, salsa dancing. She's never danced in her life. She just started salsa. And now she's like a teacher, like choreographing dances for recitals, has all these classes. She's amazing, like an amazing salsa dancer. So hot and sexy. And to think that she started when she was my age, and I'm scared to, like, I don't know, go start something new because I feel like it's too late. And I'm 27. Like, it's not. And it's not too late at 67.
It's never too late. Have you ever read The Artist's Way?
So many times.
Okay. One of my favorite, she's so great. She's so witty and so blunt. And I've read it so many times. And every time I read it, I get something new. But the one thing that always sticks with me is, I'm totally going to butcher her words, but she says something along the lines of, when you say, do you know how old I'm going to be when I learn how to play piano, or, you know, I take up that new hobby or whatever. And her response is, yeah, the same age if you don't. So do it. And I just love that so much because it's such a good perspective. And I think that we can apply that to recovery. We can apply that to so many other elements in our lives when we think about how long it's going to take. And it's like, but that time's going to go by anyways. So whether you do it or not, like, you're going to be that age. So you could be that age and, like, have this new skill or be recovered, or you could be in the exact same place. And does that always work for quieting the voice that says maybe it's too late, or, you know, you didn't learn early enough? No, I totally struggle with that. But I do remind myself, and it does help to be like, that's so true. Like, the time's going to pass anyway. So whether you do it or whether you don't, like, that's really up for us to choose.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny how so many of us decide that we've already failed when we don't give ourselves even a chance. And it reminds me of one of your viral videos. By the way, you're such a great content creator. Oh my gosh. I love following you. You had a video of just your toddler walking, and tell us about it.
So Charlotte learned how to walk right when she turned one. And I've learned so much by watching her grow and develop and try things. And we hear people tell us, you know, kids, you know, they fall down and they get up, but it's really different to see it in real life. Or I always think about how, like, we aren't born with some of the thoughts that we have. We aren't born with the fear or the pressure or whatever. We're like, yeah, yeah. And then you see it. And I watched her. She would get up and she'd fall down, and she'd get up and she'd fall down, and she'd take two steps and she'd fall down. And I mean, she would just get up 100 times. She did not stop. And it was one of those things where, first of all, the continuing to get back up, I mean, now she's running, she's sprinting. And, like, can you imagine if we had the ability at that age to doubt ourselves and to be like, well, can't do it. Might as well, like, not. We
crawl,
wouldn't be walking
for the rest of my life,
right? We wouldn't be walking. But I think also, like, as she was falling and as I was watching her, I was like, I would never say that she's failing at walking right now. So why, when I don't get something perfectly, or why when I mess up, or why when I mess up a few times, or when I don't get things, quote unquote, right away, why do I instantly go to failing? Like, why does my brain go there? Because I would never say that to her with what she's doing right now. It is, she's learning. She's trying something new. She's figuring it out. And why is it different? And it was just such a, with everything with her, I feel like it's such an aha moment, but it was such a good perspective shift to be like, why do I do that to myself? And what would happen if I did think about it the same way that I would think about it with them, with somebody else learning?
Yeah. The other thing I find interesting with kids is sometimes they fall and they laugh. Other times they fall and they cry. But always, no, not always. There comes a point, I don't know when this is developmentally, but there comes a point where kids fall and then they look to the adult to see which reaction they're supposed to have. And if the adult around them is freaking out and coddling them and being like, oh my God, are you okay? Then they start crying because that freaks them out. And sometimes if it's actually like a pretty bad fall, but the adult is like, all right, you good? Then the kid kind of reflects that too. And I even notice it in the like teens in my life. I have nieces, nephews, and sisters, and same thing. They kind of like, they might say something that's a little bit inappropriate, you know, teens like test boundaries, and then they'll side eye around the dinner table to see like how people are going to react, how they should feel about it. And that's always interesting to me because it just really shows how conditioned we become.
It really, I mean, I'm in that place right now and I will have to bite my tongue because she'll fall and I'll be like, don't react, don't react, don't react, don't react. And how easy it is for us to react too. I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Becky Kennedy because you don't have a kid yet. You are. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I've listened to so many of her interviews.
So I love her so much, whether you have a kid or not, because you can apply it to yourself as a child. And I feel like I've learned so much about myself, my clients, and then not only being a parent, but I just really, really loved her perspective recently on one of her podcasts about how important struggle is and how much we want to take it away for other people. And I am so that person, whether it is my daughter, whether it is friends, family, clients, it's like, I just want to stop this from hurting you. Of course we do. We're human beings and like we care and we love. And I think that we need to remind ourselves that struggle isn't always bad, and struggle is how we grow. And sometimes it's a really good thing when we struggle, and sometimes we have to let people struggle. It's so hard though.
It is so hard when you talk to clients who are trying to recover from binge eating and they mess up, binge, come to you the next day. Like, what do you say to them? Because I think a lot of people might call that a relapse. How do you feel about labeling it as such?
I feel like it can be a really slippery slope because it's easy to get into tracking days not binging, and then that just creates a new level of pressure rather than it being, let's not focus on the binges at all and focus on who you're becoming and the behaviors that you're implementing. And let's just not pay attention to kind of what's happening there. Because when it's just about the binging, then it becomes just about the food. And in a way, it becomes this new diet, the I'm not going to binge eat diet. And if I binge, I'm bad. And if I don't, I'm good. And it's just another trap in and of itself. And so I always like to look at it as all this means is there's more healing that needs to happen, or all this means is that you needed something and this is the way that you got your needs met, and we're just still learning. We're just still learning. And the more that we can take that approach instead of it being like, okay, well, you know what? Day one starts tomorrow. That's fine. We'll just start over. It reinforces that this is a journey and that this goes on and it goes on and it goes on, but it brings it back to the fact that this has never been about the food. And so when we can continue to look at the binges as your solution to getting your needs met, and this is just telling us that there is just some more that we need to process and learn, that's all it has to be. And then it takes the shame away and we can keep going, because that's what you need in recovery. You have to keep going.
Mm-hmm. One of your, the last thing I want to close with, because I just really liked this frame of it. You wrote like with food and like foods you crave, or maybe going back to the testing your trigger foods. You wrote, if I have what I want and I add what I need, I now have a satisfying meal. But you also have a separate post where you were eating a bagel with cream cheese and you're like, I'm not going to do jack shit for protein because it just doesn't make sense right now. I don't want it. I'm just going to have a bagel and cream cheese. It doesn't mean that much. I just like those two things side by side too, because I think that's kind of how I approach food now without really thinking about it.
And that is what I see as balance. I see it as your ability to be flexible. I see it as your ability to acknowledge that when you have a meal or a snack that has different nutrients in it, it keeps you fuller for longer. And if you don't, all that means is that you're probably going to be hungrier sooner. And that's literally it. Like, that's literally it. And I think that balance can be such an amazing tool. I think with everything, it's an amazing tool. And it's going back to you being able to move through your day and move through your life with imperfection, because there are going to be days where you're stressed or you don't have time or you're running from meetings to meetings and all you can grab is a handful of goldfish. And when you make that mean something, well, I didn't add a protein, so now I'm going to be like, that's the chaos. That's the spiral. That doesn't have to happen when it's just like, okay, I got goldfish. It's probably not going to do a whole lot, but it's going to get me from here to here. So you know what? Great. Let's make that work and let's move on. Let's get back into our lives. Let's get back to the play, the pickleball, the reading.
I was just going to say that you and I are on the same wavelength. I'm like, and now you could go read a book and play some pickleball and crochet and hang out with friends and whatever other hobbies.
Totally.
That I hope people would find more of, just to reinforce the idea that you don't have to wait until you're fully recovered to start enjoying your life. Thank you so much, Ryan. I really love this.
Thank you for having me.